Welcome to the American Cinematographer Podcast. Go behind the scenes with today's top filmmakers as they discuss the techniques they bring to the art of motion imaging.
Hello, this is Jim Hemphill, contributing writer for American Cinematographer Magazine. I am pleased to welcome you to this American Cinematographer Podcast. Today I'll be talking with cinematographer Checo Varese, ASC and AMC, about his work on 5 Days of War. Based on the real events that took place during the five-day war between Russia and the Georgian Republic in 2008, the film follows an American journalist and his cameraman as they get caught in the combat zone. During the first Russian airstrikes, the reporters rescue a young Georgian schoolteacher and agree to help her find her family in exchange for her services as an interpreter. As the group attempts to find a safe haven amidst the shooting and bombing, they witness and document devastation brought to heartbreaking life by Varese and director Rennie Harlan. Using an immediate visual style that places the viewer directly at the center of the violence, 5 Days of War combines the visceral energy of an action movie with the moral purpose and urgency of a great political documentary. I am pleased to have Checo Varese here at the ASC Clubhouse to discuss his work on the film. Before we get into 5 Days of War, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your background, because it seems relevant to this particular film. You actually began as a news cameraman, similar to the characters you document in the movie, right?
Yes, my first experience in the visual arts was to be a news cameraman. I happened to be the first news cameraman CNN ever had in El Salvador in the 80s. And one thing led to the next one, and I ended up pretty much covering political events and wars throughout the 80s, all up to 94. So it's 10, 12 years of running around.
And did you shoot in conditions as dangerous and frightening as what's depicted in this movie?
Well, there is a romanticized version of this, which is all the time you are in these conditions. Most of the time you're waiting for a prime minister to give you an interview for 3 hours in an air-conditioned room. But yes, covering the wars was very hard because of the tragedy is that you become a little bit insensitive to what you see. And it's tragic because you have to become that to be able to document it. It doesn't mean you don't feel it. It doesn't mean you don't dream at night. It doesn't mean you don't cry at night when you see something happen. But at the moment that you do it, your camera is a filter. And you see the world in this little black and white viewfinder when I did it. And I remember one time, it was actually Rwanda. I happened by luck, pure luck, to be the first cameraman that ever got there with an Air Force plane from the United Nations. And I remember recording probably 10 Betacam tapes. That's 200 minutes or something like that. And of all this tragic, it was the killing fields, basically. It was 700 people in one soccer field. And I remember not remembering anything until I stuck my last tape and gave it to my assistant. And then I just sat down and cried for probably 5 hours. I was totally devastated. It is horrible.
So when this script came to you, did you recognize, you know, things from your own experiences in it? Was this something that you related to and felt like you could bring something to because of those experiences?
I think it was a beautiful coincidence. And my agent at the time called me and said, I have a script by Rennie Harlan. He's going to look at your reel. And then after talking to Rennie, he said, well, I look at your reel and I really liked it. And I thought you had a vision and I thought you have a language and a style. But then something I never do is I went into the website and I checked it again and I saw your bio. And at that point, all the other 15 candidates were off the table with fantastic reels and beautiful cinematographers. But what interested me, he said, was your background. And I think it was a beautiful miracle or coincidence. Basically, I was his cameraman and was cinematographer, but I also was the person that the actors would come and say, this is what you do and this is how you do it, or at least how I did it. It doesn't mean that it's the correct way. It's who I was then.
So once you came on board, what were your initial discussions with Rennie Harlan? Like, did you guys come up with a sort of specific philosophy or approach to what the look of the film would be?
Yes. I mean, there are two avenues to this conversation. One, it was the actual specific look, which one of the things Rennie didn't want to do is a sexy movie. My feeling is if you do a war movie, no matter how many explosions you have, if you start putting it in slow motion and you start seeing things in a sexy, I don't know if sexy is the right word, but in a sensual way,
Right. Then
all of a sudden violence becomes attractive and violence becomes desirable. And you want to see the next shot with the next person flying through the air in slow motion and falling with an explosion. Not that there's anything wrong with that in another kind of movie, but in this movie, Rennie wanted to be very visceral, and he wanted to be in the action and inside there, and he was the first one to take and embrace this language in his very passionate and extraordinarily skillful way. And he, everything he learned through the years, which is probably to use a slow motion and a techno crane and etc., he didn't even thought about it twice. He threw it away and said, okay, how do we do this to make people feel and how to be inside the violence and inside the tragedy and inside people's heads? And that's where my background as a cameraman comes, because I've been in there. So all the handheld you see in the film, but most of it was me shooting it as if I would have been there as a cameraman. Not necessarily on the point of view, but the whole language of it. And I remember I have a fantastic focus puller, extraordinary. And sometimes I would just push him away and pull the focus myself, because I went into that mode. And I think that one of the keys to give the realism is that the camera basically takes you there.
So is that part of what led you to decide to shoot on high def as opposed to film?
Well, there were conversations about film. I'm a true believer that film is the optimum medium for any movie. But I'm also a true believer that you have to tell a story no matter what. And if the story is good and the script is good, you can shoot it with your iPhone. Yeah. And it will still be a great movie. Hopefully you can shoot it with film, but if not, you can shoot it with anything. So I'm a militant about film, but I'm not a fundamentalist.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do believe that we have to tell stories. Having said that, there was no lab in Georgia. There was no lab, period. So we would have shot 6 hours from Tbilisi by car. We would have sent the film to Sofia in Bulgaria, and then probably the dailies would have come 5 days later. And the way Rennie shoots, he shoots a lot of material, so we would forget the budget. We would have probably run out of film, period. Because I think we would have shot, I think it's 1.5 million feet of film, or 1.2 million feet of film, which is totally undoable in this kind of budget, and it's totally undoable in the conditions we were. Having said that, there were a few choices of camera. This is 2009, so the Alexa wasn't available, but the Red was available. And it was a very primitive build. It was build 21, so by now we're build 60-something, and we're with the Epic. So it's a different camera, totally. It's a different animal. But also because of my background as a news cameraman, I feel extremely comfortable with video. I understand where it dies. I understand how it dies. I understand where it works. I understand where it doesn't work. And once you embrace those conditions, it's another tool. And at some point, we had 16 cameras. So there's no way we would have had 16 loaders, 16, you know what I mean? It's just, mm-hmm. It was so massive for a small country like Georgia, in the middle of the Caucasus, you know, so it was quite an enterprise.
And what did you feel? Was this the first time you worked with the Red?
No, I did a pilot, I believe, with the Red, and I did a few commercials with the Red. But it was very quick the way it happened. I was called on a Sunday at home, emailed the script. I read the script, I called Rennie. I met him on Monday, and on Tuesday I was on a plane to Tbilisi with him. I only came back for a few days just to see my family. And the equipment was prepped in LA without me, because I was already in Georgia, which, by the way, you leave on a Monday and you get there on a Wednesday, pretty much. So the equipment was prepped here and was sent there. And we had to send 5 cables of everything, 2 lenses of everything, because there is literally nothing in Georgia. Now there's a little bit different. It has changed after 2 years, but at that point it was very bare. And to me, what the Red gave us was the ability to, first of all, shoot a lot, because most of the people were not actors, the extras were not actors, of course, but they were real people which lived throughout it. So the fear in their faces is the fear they felt a year before or 5 years before or probably 10 years before. So the Red gave us that ability. We could have shot it in Super 16 and would have gave us the same feeling. But the immediacy of it was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And could you talk a little bit about how you collaborate with your digital imaging technician on a movie like this?
Well, I was extremely lucky to have a brilliant DIT, but he's not a DIT, he's a filmmaker. It's Michael Mansouri. Michael brought the cameras with us, and the way I approach any shoot with high def is the same way I would approach it with film. I understand and I learn how the parameters are. I use my light meter that I all my life have used. And I don't have a DIT on set. I don't need one because I know what I'm recording. It's like the same concept. Why would you have photochem behind you on the set? You don't have Technicolor sitting in the track, so therefore I don't need a DIT. What Michael did for us, he was a DMT, a digital managed technician. So we would record everything. We'll give him his cards. He will have a little minivan, European little minivan with a 20-inch monitor and air conditioning. And then he would come back to the set saying, no, it looks great. It looks fantastic. Ooh, that light flickered a little bit. Can you change the bulb? Yeah, this guy was a little overexposed, but I understand you're going for the faces. So that kind of dialogue is the dialogue I had with him. We couldn't have done this movie without him. Not every DIT would have been able to sleep on a 1950s Russian train, the bathroom being across the train station, and it was a military tent with latrines, and working 18 or 19 hours a day. His passion and the passion of my crew was extraordinary.
Well, this something that has come up several times in this conversation. I guess I'm curious to hear what it was like shooting a movie in a country where I'm assuming there have been very few movies actually made, if any, on this scale.
Where Georgia is a very interesting, fantastic place. First of all, Tbilisi is like a European city. You go to Tbilisi and have extraordinary restaurants, modern hotels. I don't think I remember staying in a better hotel than the one in Tbilisi in all my life. It's like fantastic. And that was the point of the movie, try to convey that this is not some place in the middle of nowhere that has no culture. I mean, the Georgians invented the wine 5,000 years ago. So there is an extraordinary culture. When the Soviet Union was around, Georgia was one of the republics of the Soviet Union. But because of the weather, Georgia was known in the Soviet country for being provider of two things. One is vegetables. All the fruit and the vegetables of the Soviet Union came from Georgia, or most of them. But the other one was the film industry. Because as Los Angeles, for us, is the best weather you can find in the Soviet Union. I mean, you're not going to build a studio in Siberia because half of your year is going to be under the snow. So the Georgian had a fantastic film industry up to 91. I mean, Soviet propaganda movies, but very famous. So most of your movies that you've seen of that era are from Georgia. So there is a tradition, there is a film festival, there is a tradition of theater and movies. Between 91 and 2009, with all the crises and the revolutions and the invasions and the wars and etc., that movie industry died. So there is a whole generation that doesn't know anything about that. So my focus puller was the son of a famous focus puller. My camera assistant was the grandson of an extraordinary director, but they never done it. There is a little bit of a local television industry, there is a little bit of a local movie, but nobody did anything at this scale there. One of the main locations, it's a town called Salka, where it's basically where all the invasion and all the bombing and etc. we did in this town. The story of the town is fascinating. In World War II, when the retreat of the Nazis, they retreated from Greece up to Turkey and then around and then through Georgia up to Austria, hoping that they got stopped there by the Soviet Union. There was this community of either refugees or collaborators, Nazi collaborators, or just people kidnapped by the Nazi troops that were from Greece. So they crossed the border and they got stopped by the Russians. And this community of 2,000 people got stopped in the middle of the steppe in this place called Salka. So with the openness of this new Georgian government, the European community, these families, three generations later, were relocated in Greece. So this town was abandoned. But like abandoned, like a ghost town. There were curtains in the streets. There were cars left there because they all left in a rush to go back to Greece. So we had the town at our disposal because that town would have been abandoned anyway. And I mean, some of the houses were dilapidated, but other houses were not that dilapidated. So what you see in there, it's an abandoned town. Well, this town happened to be 6.5 hours driving from Tbilisi near the border of Turkey. And of course, when the first Georgian local producer said, well, we're going to shoot there 3 weeks, the producer and myself said, okay, so how are you going to house 150 people? And they looked at us with stared eyes saying, well, the crew is going to be 30. I'm like, no, the crew is going to be probably 120 people. So there were nothing. And one of the solutions that I believe Rennie came up with is, let's bring a train and a sleeper car and let's all sleep in the sleeper car. So they had to beat the bathrooms for that. But those were only a couple of weeks. Then after that, we shot in Tbilisi most of it. And Gori, which is the place where Stalin was born. And there was a big Stalin statue in the movie that actually the government stopped from taking it apart so we could shoot the movie there. So they delayed the Stalin statue there for 2 months until we shot the scenes.
So you said you had a crew of over 100 people in a place where there's now not much of a film industry. Where did the crew come from? I mean, was it...
Rennie had his assistant coming from the States, assistant director, and one of the producers came from the States, and my DIT came from the States. Everybody else, at least in the camera department, we had 7 nationalities and 7 languages. My focus puller came from Mexico. My second camera assistant came from Spain. My other camera assistant came from Spain. 1 local camera assistant from Georgia. 2 Lithuanians, 1 Estonian, and 5 Bulgarians. And the grip crew was exactly the same. Some local people. My gaffer was from Australia, originally from Israel. So he spoke Hebrew and English. And... my key grip was from Canada, so it was pretty much a multinational. We have a picture in the somewhere, the camera truck with the 17 flags from every country. So it was quite an enterprise. Some days we constantly had 2 or 3 cameras every day, every shot. I operated a camera and then was a steady cam operator from Italy. I forgot him, so it's an Italian steady cam operator. And then we have a 3rd camera, but some days we ended up one day we had 16 cameras rolling at the same time.
So how are you communicating with, what's the communication like between everyone when you're doing one of these massive set pieces in the movie where you've got 16 cameras running?
Well, I'm a lucky person. I speak several languages, so I speak 8 languages, and one of them is English. And the chain of command was Rennie to me in English, myself to half of the crew in Spanish, then half of the crew in a little bit of Russian that I speak. And then from there, we had a translator, invaluable, Tamara. And she would translate to either Georgian, Russian, or Bulgarian, which were the other 3 languages. Whatever I couldn't pronounce in my rusty Russian, she will correct me. But it was interesting because at some point, first of all, I think film, it's a universal language. Everybody calls a matte box. And that helps. But it also, by the 2nd or 3rd day, it was instinctual. You know, I am a firm believer that leadership is about letting people do what they do best and just direct them in the direction that you know they can do best their thing. So I have a tendency not to micromanage my crew. I do micromanage them on prep, but then after that, they all know what they need to do, and I assume that they all know what they need to do. And it was very interesting, the way it all worked out in 17 languages. One day we had 16 cameras in the big exodus from what is supposed to be Gori, which is towards the middle of the movie. I remember at 4:30 in the morning, I was in this huge esplanade, probably 5 miles by 3 miles, which in the background has this dilapidated city. And I remember being in a quad bike with Rennie in my back. He was holding 16 orange cones with a yellow pad. So we started driving around and we dropped a cone in the middle of the field with a yellow pad saying B camera and 16 millimeter lens, C camera. So we dropped 16 cones And then we build the scaffolding for that one. We put the technocrane with the crane on the other one. And that morning, we had a crew of, my usual crew was 8 in the camera department, so we had a crew of probably 20, which some of them were film students from film school, or somebody was, I remember one of the camera was in charge of somebody's cousin. He was like, press the red button. When I say action, press the red button. And it worked out pretty well. And I remember having a megaphone and talking to 20 people. I felt like a construction worker. So at 8 o'clock in the morning, we did the first rehearsal with 5 military helicopters, 2 jets, Sukhoi Su-22s, 2 attack jets, 85 tanks, 20-something military vehicles of other assortment, 500 troops, 2,500 extras that are villagers that were refugees from that particular war, 400 civilian vehicles, and I didn't count the cows and the dogs and the chickens. And so at 8, we did the rehearsal. At 8:30, we did the first shot, and I was operating a camera on a technocrane. At 9:30, I was on top of a tank doing a shot with a handheld camera. At 11, I was on a military helicopter outside the window shooting handheld from the chopper during the pass. By 2 p.m., I was on a military jet with a G9 suit, handheld again, looking at the pilot behind me and panning towards the supposedly bombing. And by 3 p.m., I started smoking again, which I quit for 7 years. That was it. That was too much. But that was one day. But not all the other days were smaller than that. So it was a pretty massive attempt. I don't think in the last few years, other than probably some movies in China where they have the resources to pull thousands of extras, I've never been in a set with 2,500 extras before in my life. I've been in a set with 200 extras, and then the other 2,300 are digitally enhanced.
Right.
If you look at the dailies of the movie, there is very, 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 very digital work in there. The only digital work there is, actually, I have to say, is the tracing of the rockets between the attack helicopters and the target. That, of course, we couldn't do for real, because then you have to shoot a real rocket. But the explosion in the floor, it's for real. The smoke, it's for real. The planes are for real. The helicopters are for real. The tanks are for real. The dogs, the people, everything is for real. The only thing that they digitally enhance is the tracing of that. The very first day of the movie, the troops shot 160,000 rounds of ammunition. In the first day of the Gulf War, the first one, I think the American troops shot 25,000 rounds in the first day of that whole war. In the first day of this rehearsal, of this shot, we shot 160,000 rounds of ammunition. I remember living for 3 months with headsets.
Right. So where do all these, the tanks and the planes, I mean, where does all that come from? Did you have cooperation from the Georgian government?
This is. I think it's important to make clear that Rennie never meant to do a pro-Georgian against Russian movie or a pro-Russian against Georgian. He never meant to do that. He meant to expose the truth of this tragic event. We did have the collaboration of the Georgian government and the Georgian military. I don't think they were at our disposal, but they were very, very, very keen to help us. Of course, with a very delicate balance, because sometimes we were too close to the Russian border. Georgia is a small country. You can fly from one side to the other one in probably 20 minutes. And sometimes the jets would travel for us, but they would get scrambled by Russian jets, because what are 2 jets doing flying over and over and over and over near the border? So it was quite delicate as a balance.
And was there also a delicate balance just among people working on the movie? Because I'm assuming you had people who, you mean, you mentioned the extras, but also I'm assuming crew people, and that there were a lot of people who had been close to this conflict that only happened a year before you started shooting.
At one moment, Rennie hired the special effect crew and the stunt crew from Russia for many reasons. One of them is because they're extraordinary, and the other one is, I guess, accessibility and travel and this and that. So one time we're in a van, we're going to the airport to see the military helicopter. We get out of the helicopter and we say hello in English to the colonel that then introduced us to the military base so we could see the choppers and this and that and the other. So So I say hello, Sergio Guarese, the cinematographer, Rennie Harnan, the director, Vladimir Darara, stunt coordinator. Immediately silence. Two military guys behind us cocked their guns. What are these Russians doing here? They're spies. What are they doing here? We'll get them out of here. You're spies too. What are you doing here? It was a very tense moment. 12 months before, they were invaded by the Russian troops. So it took a lot of negotiation. It took a lot of diplomacy. And at the end, people are people. And we all should live together in a world without attacking or invading anybody. So at the end, it was a fantastic collaboration between the Russian stunt coordinator, the Georgian pilot, and the Russian explosive expert that did all that. But it was quite fascinating to see what the politics of that was, briefly.
Well, and how about the extras who were working on the movie? Because a lot of them had lived through this as well. I mean, did you sense that they were comfortable reliving this event? Or
most of the extras that we used in the conflict scenes or in the action scenes or in the violent scenes were people that either lived through it or had somebody that lived through it. I think it was cathartic for most of us. It was cathartic for them for sure. There are two moments that are interesting. One of the moments is when Sebastian, the cameraman, gets hurt by an explosion and the reporter has to make a choice whether to stay with him or go. I remember shooting it handheld very close to him, and the actor did a fantastic job, and he did it again and again. And by the fifth time, I just turned up and said to Rennie, I'm sorry, I can't do this anymore. And I just went to a corner and sat for a long time. And this is something that happened to me in 84, and I didn't remember. I had an assistant that tragically shot, and I just probably erased it from my memory. If you asked me, I would have said, yes, of course, this happened, but it wasn't something I remembered. And this was a cathartic moment for me. All my ghosts came back and came out of it in this particular moment. And there is another scene in the movie when Andy Garcia, that plays the president of Georgia, there is the historical event that he goes out in the main square and there is, I don't know how many, a million people in the streets with Georgian flags. Because what the feeling was is that they should, the more people there in the street, the less possibilities of a military strike would happen. You know, so in the script, there is this moment. So the producers wanted to recreate the moment. So they just announced it on the radio and said, whoever wants to come will come. There's a scene in the movie with 12 to 20,000 people that, of course, are not extras. They're the people that came to the rally. And Andy Garcia came out and gave a speech and said, this is a movie, recreating, blah, blah, blah. Well, I shot the crowd. I was shooting Andy and the crowd. And people were crying in the crowd, screaming, Georgia, Georgia, Georgia. And there were people reliving their moment. There is an old lady, I never remember, there's an old lady that is weeping in tears. It probably because she was there a year before. And there were kids doing the V sign with their fingers, and they were just crying or smiling or happy. So I think for the whole country, it was an experience. And arguably, for me, it was an extraordinary experience, personally.
How long were you actually there? Was it a shoot? How long was the shoot?
I can't remember how long was the shoot. I believe it was 6 weeks.
Wow.
Five-day week, 6 weeks. But I was there for 3 months. So I flew in and I came back 3 months later.
So, well, let's wrap up by talking a little bit about post. Where did you do the final color grading and all that kind of stuff?
The movie was edited here, and then the color grading was done at Warner Brothers with a fantastic colorist, Maxime Gervais. Most of the coloring she did based on the dailies, and then we went in and tweaked a little bit more. We used several different cameras and builds, and some of the reds were not build 21 because we got that day one red that somebody had there and we grabbed it. So it was quite a challenge to debayer this whole disaster, but she did a great job. And we colored it there and we printed at Technicolor. Actually, when I screened the movie at Technicolor, that day was announced that Technicolor, the Valley, was closing. So that was the last movie ever screened in Technicolor, which is actually quite tragic. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we did it here, and the movie got printed in Kodak stock. And one thing I forgot to... We did use a high-speed camera called the Red Lake, which was quite remarkable. And there were some explosions or scenes that we ended up shooting at 800 frames, which was quite interesting, and I was very happy with the results. But little by little during the editing, Rennie started trimming this slow motion, which we talked before about it, just to avoid the sexiness of it, right, which is what makes war so desirable sometimes.
Well, I think you definitely achieved your goal of doing a very visceral, realistic war movie, and I appreciate you coming by to talk about it.
Thank you very much.
This has been Jim Hempel, and check over ASC and AMC talking about 5 Days of War.
This has been the American Cinematographer Podcast. Thanks for listening. You can find more podcasts, blogs, and exclusive ASC content by logging onto theasc.com. This podcast has been brought to you by the American Society of Cinematographers, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the art and craft of cinematography.